Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program this week. My guest here in studio is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Mayor. As always, we appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me, Stan.
And remember, you can call in your questions today by calling 765-496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we talked last month on the show, just after the passing of Birch Bayh, of your remembrances of him. And while the two of you didn't overlap in office at all, Richard Lugar just passed away. And obviously, you two did overlap a fair amount in office. I wanted to get your remembrance of him and get a sense of what your relationship with him was like.
Well, thank you. I mean, I did have the opportunity to meet Senator Lugar on several occasions when we took trips out to Washington, D.C. With the chamber group that we always went. We always met with Senator Lugar, and a couple things that just stand out in my mind that you've heard from a lot of people is he was always the consummate gentleman. He was very polite, very respectful. He was always very well prepared when we went. He always had a presentation to give us and to go over issues that were occurring in Washington and things that he was directly involved with. And then he was always open to answering questions. He never seemed to be in a hurry to get out of the room. He wanted to make sure that we had the information that we wanted, and really just a gentleman, and very, very bipartisan when we would be there, and always trying to explain why things were getting done or weren't getting done and what his view on that was and how he hoped that, you know, they could find some ways to make things happen, and just really the kind of person and statesman that I think, you know, was a role model, as you've heard, for a lot of people, and always enjoyed that visit and always looked forward to that visit. It was just a very relaxed, enjoyable time. And then the other part that I remember, and I've told people this since he had left office in the Senate, the other thing that was just remarkable was his staff. Nobody, you know, in that time period remotely responded back as quick as Senator Lugar's staff did. If I sent something to them from my office, we had a question or something that need followed up on, his staff was just impeccable. They got back with you most of the times that day and at least let you know that they had received your inquiry and they would be looking into it and it would be assigned, and then quickly got back with answers or who you should contact if they weren't the right point of contact, and just continually, I don't remember that ever not being the case. In fact, I remember one morning specifically, I had sent them something. I think it was about the federal courthouse downtown during a period when they were even talking about maybe closing federal courthouses and different things. And I sent that in the morning and had some activities in the afternoon away from the office, and my phone went off and it said Washington, D.C. And I looked down and it was one of his staff members calling my cell phone yet that day saying, hey, we saw what we're looking into it and here's some basic information. His staff did a great job.
You mentioned the bipartisanship, which of course is something that a lot of people have talked about over the last several days. You and I have talked, and I've talked with a bunch of other mayors about the job that you do, which a lot of people say, when done right, shouldn't matter whether there's a D or an R or an I next to your name. You're a municipal manager. You're taking care of things that affect people's lives. Was there anything that you found that you learned about being a mayor from the way that Senator Lugar operated his Senate office, do you think?
Well, I mean, I just think that, you know, I know from the way his staff followed up, you know, how that makes you feel when you get that response quickly like that and people take what you're asking seriously, and also the way that he was able to build, you know, long-term relationships across the aisle with people of the other party and his party during difficult times, and work with Sam Nunn on some very important work that they did when it came to nuclear weapons. And, you know, I always admired that as a way that we should all try to conduct ourselves and find that way to get those things things done, because he really was about getting things done. And as you said, at the local level, that's incredibly important for us. And we got to get it done quicker, right? Because people's day, what's going on day to day in their lives relates back to what we're doing many times. And I think that's a good lesson for all of us. And I hope more people would, emulate that.
On to some things that are going on around here. I was at Columbian Park the other day with my daughter. We noticed the new water slides going in. She was very excited for those. But you were telling me before the program that those are one project that the recent heavy rains we've had might be slowing down a little bit. Are those still on schedule to be in by the time the pool opens around Memorial Day?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's going to be a close call. That's going to come down to the wire. You know, the earlier rains that we had and the weather that we had earlier in the late winter and early spring slowed us down, and then we had an opportunity to catch up with the crews in there working, and we had just about made up all the time that we lost. And now the rain that we've had here for the last several days, and how saturated the ground is, and it's going to take time to dry out even once it stops raining, that's going to be close. I mean, there's a chance that we'll get there, but there's a chance that we won't. Now, we'll definitely get them open sometime in June then, if they don't open right at the end of the May, and they'll be open for most of the summer. But unless we have about the next 20 some days of pure sunshine and warm weather, that's probably going to be really iffy for us.
Are there other projects that you're also looking at the timelines on because of the rain?
Well, I mean, the thing that's kind of hurting us right now with the rain this week is we had moved, you know, we'd kind of got caught up on just the general potholes from a very difficult winter, but not all of them, but we got caught up on a big chunk. And so we moved some crews over to Midnight so we could start what we call skip patching, where the road's either failed or there's a lot of potholes in a row, where we actually come in and we mill out a certain section and clean it all out. Then we actually pave that and roll it with an actual roller. So we got a lot of those milled out, and then of course the rain has hit, and you can't put the asphalt back in while it's raining and stuff. And so we have some of those setting open that we would prefer were not setting open that long. We've got signs up that say bumps and different things, but we'd prefer that those had been able to get closed up sooner. So we're hoping that the rain stops and that we can get clawed up on up to some things at the park. We do have the penguin exhibit that we're working on. Fortunately, we got most of the underground work done on that before the rain hit, so we shouldn't get stalled too much on that, as long as the rain stops here pretty soon, because we did get a lot of that underground work done before this last batch of rain.
I'm glad you mentioned the potholes. I wanted to address something that the city is doing. You've signed a contract with a company out of Massachusetts called Street Scan, and I was looking at their website before the show, and it's kind of interesting. They've got these vans that they drive around that have cameras and other sensors on them, and they're looking at the roads, and they're trying to give you kind of as real time a map of what the roads look like as possible. I'm curious what you as the city want to know from them that you couldn't get, for instance, by citizens sending you notes on the city's app going, look, there's a pothole at 9th and Columbia or something like that.
Well, you know, what we're actually trying to take that, not just for the pothole range, we're trying to take that for the overall paving and maintenance schedule of the road, everything from what needs to be totally reconstructed to what needs what we, you know, call where we would mill down an inch and a half and just put a top coat back on, to what might need not totally reconstructed, because part of the sub base and the basin binder is good, and so we don't need to do full depth patching, and then actually rate all of those roads in those different categories of which ones truly need to be done first, that would need reconstructed, which ones can just do a mill and pave, which one needs what we call deep patching done, then ones that are still good and they can just be crack sealed to get so many more years out of it. So our new city engineer, he's been with us for not quite 2 years yet, but his background is traffic. You know, we have engineers with civil backgrounds and water and wastewater, and his is traffic. And he came from the private sector where he ran a traffic division for a company called American Structure Point, which is a large engineering firm. And he actually was in charge of a three-state area. And so he is putting processes in place for us that he feels will make us much more efficient in how we rebuild our roads, how we pave our roads, when we crack seal, and by using this data and this rating and some things he's going to do, he thinks we will be able to spread our paving dollars a lot farther. And so,
is this more about prioritizing and giving yourself a list of these projects need to be done in this order, or is it about finding out about issues that you don't yet know about?
Well, it's a little bit of both. With some of the sensors that you said that they have, and then finding out about things that we don't know, and some things you still have to do borings, you have to do cores to know for sure, but you can get some real ideas and then help prioritizing those roads. You know, we have about 290 road miles in the city limits, long roads that don't get as much travel, some roads that gets tons of cars on it. But they all needed it at certain times, and you've got to weigh all those factors, and this data will help him begin to put that long-term plan together. You know, with the amount of money that we have, you've got to make a road last 10 to 12 years if you're going to make it all work out. And so you've got to do them at the right time. You've got to crack seal them at the right time. And we're going to use this data to put together a much more robust and comprehensive a program to utilize all those monies efficiently as possible and make sure we're doing the roads that need it and doing to them, what need. There's a big difference between just doing an inch and a half mill and a top coat back on as opposed to a road where the sub base is actually failing too. But the whole road sub base might not be failing. It may just be a 30-foot stretch that's failing. And so there's actually quite a bit to it. We think this data is going to help us a lot make those decisions.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. Thanks for being with us on the program. Call in your questions at 496-1999. Send emails to ask@wbaa.org. We'll get your questions on the show today. We talked last month on the program about the bidding process for Loeb Stadium. You'd said at that time it would be a few weeks. It's been a few weeks since we saw you. I wanted to know what was the latest on the 50 or so bids that you'd gotten in, at least at that point.
Yeah, we're still going through those. I think in the next couple of weeks we'll bring them back to the Board of Works to actually announce them to the public, which company got those. We're looking through to make sure all the calculations are correct. We're looking through to see if there's any value engineering that can be done, looking at the lowest.
No, wait, when you say value engineering, what do you mean?
Well, is there any way, looking at how the bids were turned in, where we think that we could possibly save some money, just kind of checking each one of those and everybody's calculations. So I think in the next 2 weeks we'll actually come forward with the final winners in each of those categories and be able to make those announcements, and we'll be right on schedule to tear the old stadium down. Whatever the last Aviators game is, August the 6th, but if they make it to the playoffs, then it might not be the last game, and so it would go on a little further. So we don't know exactly when that is, but sometime there in August we'll be right on track to get the stadium down. We don't see anything in the bids at this point with the way that we save our money and what we've thought about that would stop the project from going forward.
And again, target opening date for the new stadium is?
If everything went smooth and there was no weather issues or anything like that, it should be done at the end of 2020. But we've got ourselves a little cushion if it runs over into 2021 a little bit. The field needs to be for like the first Jeff High School practice of the 2021 season. They start practicing in March of 2021. So if it did run over a little bit, we have the first couple months of 2021 to tighten it up and finish it up.
as I've been driving across the Columbia Street Bridge on the way to work every day, it looks to me, I'm not an engineer, like the promenade next to the Mark, which we've been talking about on the show for a long time now, finally maybe nearing completion?
Yeah, we had to order some additional lumber. It's Kumaru, so it's kind of a specialty lumber, so they have been waiting on that a little bit, and we've been addressing some of the other concerns that we've had, and we've got those all just about worked out, and we are definitely moving in a positive direction, and I can't give you an exact opening date this year, but I am confident it will open, probably early this summer. So,
is there a plan to open up a section of, as you're walking up that sidewalk that goes along the Columbia Street Bridge, are you going to be able to enter the promenade from that sidewalk? Do you know? As you're heading across the bridge?
Yes.
There's a rail there now.
Yeah, they'll wait to the very last minute, but yes, that rail will be cut, and the promenade will actually attach to the ramp of the bridge there, and yes, you'll be able to walk all the way across from Reilly Plaza and exit that way, or vice versa, start there on Columbia Street and walk across.
Okay. One of the things we didn't get to last month that I realized we didn't have time for, so I thought I'd allot some time in this month's program, is we've been talking about the 5 points area on this show over the last year or so, and you've said, hey, it's probably going to be 3, 4, 5 years before we really get started reinvigorating that area before you get people building stuff and investors submitting bids for things. But I wanted to sort of get out in front of talking about not that part of it, but indeed the homes that are kind of surrounding that area. As you head up South Street, as you head onto some of the arterials, 16th Street, some of the houses, some of the buildings, they need some TLC. They need some help. And this brings into the discussion a word that a lot of people in urban planning these days see as kind of a four-letter word, even though it has many more letters than that, which is gentrification. And I wanted to ask, as you are looking at the process of redoing this and building this corridor that goes from 5 points down the street to the park and all of its new amenities and the new baseball stadium, is gentrification almost the goal? Is it almost the way that it kind of has to be to make that vision a reality of reinvigorating this whole, half mile, mile long stretch?
Yeah, I mean, I think, when you look at the, and that's a fair question, I mean, when you look at the area, there are a lot of commercial spaces and different businesses there, older businesses that aren't necessarily people's residents that, could take up a significant portion of some of that redevelopment if they were put together right and the parcels were put together right, where you wouldn't be, directly into what you would call the housing neighborhood area. But with that being said, I mean, in all honesty, you would want part of this project to help raise the standard of and the quality of those homes in that neighborhood. So you hope that a couple things would happen. One, that because of new investment, some of the investors, because there are a lot of rental properties in there, and there are a lot of properties that have been single family homes at one time, but have been divided up into multiple units. So, you would hope that people that own those properties, because the city is not going to come in and take people's property. We've made that clear that we put a plan together. We've shown you what we can do with the water and the sewer and how we can realign streets and how we could help put in the trails and sidewalks and maybe even a small pocket park if the land opened up right, but and help bring people together. But we're not going to become a developer, right? We're not going to be developing properties ourselves. So we would hope that some of the private owners, as some of that other investment would made, probably starting with some of them commercial buildings, would see that it's good to make an investment in that neighborhood. And quite frankly, I mean, I'm not beating around the bush. Some of them need to do that anyway right now. Some of those properties are not in good condition and they need to do a better job of taking care of those and taking care pride in the properties that they own.
I wanted to ask about that because there's a couple of ways that can happen. You could have a new investor come in and offer to just throw a bunch of money at the people who currently own those properties, and then the new investors can do whatever they want, whether it's tear the thing down or build it up to a nicer standard. And then you could also have, we talked with Chris McBarnes a frequent amount about what's going on in Frankfurt. He's got the same problem where he's got a lot of nice old single family houses, former single family houses that have been subdivided into 3, 4, 6 apartments in some cases, which you've got as you come up South Street there, particularly on the north side of the road. And so there's the question of, what does the city do versus what does the city encourage the new investors to do? How do you find that balance of you giving a direction to the project, but at the same time not being seen as evicting people, which is often what people cite as a nasty side effect of gentrification of an area where maybe you just want to raise the standard of what it looks like and feels like?
All right. I think the answer for that is, and I know this answer is going to make some people mad on this side of the issue and some people mad on this side of the issue, but this is what I think and believe, is that, you know, we would work to bring investment to the area that would hopefully spur some of those folks to do the right things and to make those investments. And where that didn't happen, we would work with developers to see if some of those properties could be acquired, and either where they would fix them up, or in some cases, if they don't really add to the neighborhood, they are in such poor condition that it's just not a feasible thing, then to look at ways to tear those down and put things back up in an infill method. And there are infill methods, and we want a mixed neighborhood. There are mixed use neighborhood and different backgrounds. And so you could infill with affordable housing. You could infill with, apartments that were, I'm not talking about vouchers, but I mean that were affordable. Not everything has to be.
So you don't see it as Section 8, for instance.
Right, not Section 8, but everything doesn't have to be the Taj Mahal to still be nice, fit the character of the neighborhood, and then blend that with other properties of different levels. So it would be nice if people of different income levels and different backgrounds could live in that neighborhood together. And that's been successful in communities, places where people have been able to do that. So I would see us do a combination of things that should be saved and can be turned into good things or worked on. We would do that in areas where it just doesn't make sense to do that, to try to raise the whole neighborhood. We would look to, some of those would probably go away. I tell you what I think, and that's what I think.
Do you think that the current state of the neighborhood there, where you've got some neat old building stock with some good character that could be turned into something really cool if you redevelop it the right way, you've got some things that, as you correctly point out, I think just need to be torn down and you start from scratch, does the current state of it help you or hurt you, do you think, in terms of getting investors, particularly housing investors who might want to put up new buildings or might want to redevelop properties? I could see it a couple of ways. One, they're a little sketchy about, well, what is the rest of the neighborhood like? Or two, maybe they think they can get it for a cheaper price and then they can make money faster.
Both of those analyses can actually happen. I think there's a third thought on this, and I've mentioned it before when you and I have talked, and I've mentioned it in public. I think what's going to be one of the biggest catalysts of how that neighborhood changes and how it actually begins to develop is the work that we're doing in Columbian Park and how that affects the Columbian Park neighborhood and the Oakland neighborhood, and how that kind of pushes that direction. And then coming up Main Street Hill from downtown, because we do have some interest from some developers looking at coming up part of Main Street Hill, that as those two bookends begin to converge on that neighborhood and those developments that aren't actually right in the Five Point area begin to take shape, I think that's going to be a big catalyst in helping get some things done, and what those projects look like and how it meets the needs, and where investors and developers see an opportunity to meet the need of, we don't have what don't we have right here, and what don't we have right here that we could put right here and use the amenities out this way, and this would still be very attractive to people and can be done in a way that's, there will be a return on their investment, but it still will be good for the community. Because if anybody wants us to participate, or before we would pay to change a road alignment, or before we would change due to put a trail or a new sidewalk in, we're going to want to make sure that what they're doing, you know, fits the vision of the city and takes all the things into consideration that we've talked about today. And it's going to be important to us that people of all socioeconomic levels have an opportunity to have good quality housing and a high quality of life and do things in a way that can blend that and make it happen.
What do you envision will be the communication with the current residents of that area about, hey, if you plan to still be here in 5, 7, 10 years, this is what we, the city, envision will happen? How do you have those conversations?
You know, I mean, that won't be easy, because also that is, some of that area is rather transient. And so, you know, we would have to do that. A lot of that would be with the property owners, too, that actually own the homes. And then there are some homeowners in there. And so, you know, I think as we get some of these other projects done, you know, we look at how we take that to the next level, or when we get the first real bite at the apple, when we think we have somebody that's really serious about doing something, which would probably be with the commercial space first. But, you know, that first one's really hard to get. And the second one's pretty hard, but not quite as hard as the first one. And then it starts to get a little bit easier as you get it. So I probably, once we get that first really serious project, which I do believe will be probably in a commercial space, unless something unusual happens with some properties that might become available that we could get. I mean, I haven't made a secret about this. If somehow we could get the right person to snag those blue kind of apartment units on the side, we would try to work with somebody to get that and to try to do something with that pretty quickly. But I think other than that, it's probably going to be a commercial space. And then,
so as you're having conversations between the developers and the existing landlords, would there be a point where you could, where the city could be kind of a middleman and go to the landlords and say, look, if you're the owner of those blue properties, which are among, I have to say, the biggest eyesores in that area, just to be perfectly frank about it, would you go to the landlord and say, hey, look, I got a developer here. He's going to throw a bunch of money at you. You should really consider taking that deal.
Well, I don't know if I would phrase it just like that, but I understand the premise.
That's why you're the mayor and not me.
And, you know, sometimes it would just depend on what the offer was. I mean, the developers typically don't throw huge sums of money, because there is a limit to what that area will be able to produce and what prices would able to be, or rents will able to be. And if we want to try to make it a mixed use income level area too, so everybody gets a chance to use some of those amenities. So, but
sure, but it is common practice for people to overpay a little bit on the front end just to kind of grease the skids and get what they want.
If the property holds a unique value or a unique position for the development, sometimes that happens. So I think the way I would answer that is, would the city be part of negotiations? Have we been before on other projects at some level, especially if we're going to put some type of incentive into it? The answer is absolutely yes. But I just can't, and I'm not being evasive, my crystal ball doesn't go quite that far out. And so I want to be careful what I say. But would we be involved in discussions at some level, if necessary? Yes.
Yeah, and obviously we're asking you to look several years down the road, and there will be, I imagine, more of these sorts of conversations on this program about this very thing. So, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time, and we'll do it again next month.
Thanks, Dan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We want to point out that our conversation next week with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis will have been pre-taped. So if you want to get questions on for that, send those pretty soon to ask@WBAA.org. We're going to talk with him Monday afternoon of next week. And you can find all these shows archived at our website, WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.